On September the 9th, 2010, while embedded with an army unit and talking with locals in a small village in eastern Afghanistan, journalist Carmen Gentil was struck in the face by a rocket-propelled grenade. Inexplicably, the grenade did not explode, and Gentil survived, albeit with the right side of his face shattered and blinded in one eye. Making matters worse, his engagement was on the ropes and his fiancée was absent from his bedside. He survived and returned to Afghanistan. It's the subject of a fascinating a wonderful new book called Blindsided by the Taliban, a journalist story of war, trauma, love and lust. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US, Carmen Gentil. Carmen, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, on this Monday morning. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be embedded with a US Army unit in eastern Afghanistan. What had led up to that point, to that fateful morning on September 9th?
Well, I had been working as an embedded journalist in Afghanistan and Iraq for a number of years. So it was just part of my regular routine covering the war. And I had spent a lot of time in eastern Afghanistan at that time because it was one of the focal points of the fighting in Afghanistan. It was that time when the U.S. had sent 100,000 plus more troops to and had 100,000 plus troops in Afghanistan at that time. It was the surge that President Obama ordered. They were really ramping up their efforts to try to get a handle on the situation because all the attention in the years few years previously had been in Iraq. The story was now being the attention was now returning to Afghanistan. I've always liked working there. It's a beautiful, fascinating, head-scratching, frustrating country. And that's how I wound up being in Kunar province, which is right next to the Pakistani border, on that fateful day.
And what were you doing? I mean, but just from the notes I was giving you, was literally just standing around chatting to some villages, and then out of nowhere, bam, you know,
well,
you.
What happened was we were walking around in this village on a foot patrol. It was the last day of Ramadan. And the locals there were preparing for their end of Ramadan feast. And here come these U.S. forces accompanied by Afghan soldiers as well, walking in. And they didn't seem too happy to see us. And so we were just trying to get a sense of the pulse of the people there. And I was talking to two guys, and I was holding my video camera at the time. And having a conversation with them, and then I heard this loud whoosh sound, and I turned around, and I saw about 50 meters down the road, there was a guy shouldering an RPG launcher, and the ordnance was screaming right toward me and smacked me in the side of the head. And I managed to catch some of that on my video camera.
Oh, really? You actually caught it on film, the RPG that hit you?
Yeah, it's one of my claims to fame. Yeah, I did catch it on camera.
And I mean, just explain to those who wouldn't know, when you're embedded in with an army unit, I mean, do you look, I mean, apart from the fact that you're lugging a piece of video camera with you, which perhaps could look like a weapon to anybody else, did you look any different? Did you have "pressed" written across your chest in large letters, or do you just think they were just...
I'm wearing civilian clothes. The Kevlar that I was wearing that day, nothing had "press" written on it, but it's, I'm not wearing a uniform. I'm not carrying a weapon. Do enemy combatants differentiate? No. Do I think he was targeting me specifically? No. I just happened to be standing amidst the crowd and the one that was lucky enough to catch it in the side of the head.
I mean, you're lucky enough to catch it in the side of the head. You're lucky enough the thing didn't go off.
If it would have gone off, obviously we wouldn't be having this conversation and they would have sent me home in a matchbook.
That's one way of putting it. What was the next thing you remember? I mean, were you conscious? Did you come to?
No, I never lost consciousness. The thing hit me in the side of the head and I had this powerful ringing in my skull. And I went down to one knee and my camera went flying. And I remember touching my face. Immediately my eye went black. And I thought, well, I'm either dead and this is the experience, or I just had my eye popped out and I put my hand to my face to touch where I thought my eye would be an empty hole. And it was just covered in blood. And then blood started streaming between my fingers and onto the ground. And the first thing I did was ask the medics who were treating me. I said, look, do I still have my eye? Be honest with me, because I'm pretty sure it just was ejected out of my head. And they said, no, you still have it. But obviously I couldn't see out of it.
Right. And there's, I mean, on the front cover of the book, Blindsided by the Taliban, is that's the picture of you shortly after having taken the injury?
Yeah. There were actually a group of Latvian soldiers that were working with the Afghan soldiers at this small combat outpost, and they were with us that day too. And one of them was kind enough to take pictures to document the happening. There are a few pictures floating around out there of me being treated and being taken away.
What happened next? I mean, you were sort of taken off to a field hospital and then ended up in Germany at the to be treated for these severe injuries.
Yes, I had my first operation at the U.S. NATO base at Bagram in Afghanistan, and a military surgeon, an ophthalmologist, managed to fix the globe of my eye. I won't get into all the gory details, but it had been lacerated. The stuff that's inside your eye that gives it its shape and size had come out, and he had to put it back in, and they did fix that part. But when I woke up in that hospital in Bagram, I had a nurse tell me, you know, you're going to lose that eye. There's no chance you're going to keep it. And, so I was a little obviously bummed about that, but I was so sedated, I hardly knew what the hell was going on. And then I was flown to the U.S. military base in Landstuhl in Germany, a couple days later, actually on September 11th.
Yeah, I read that in the blog. You describe it as the gift that keeps on giving, September the 11th.
Yeah, September 11th is the gift that keeps on giving to me. So then there they told me, well, it looks a little bit better than we thought. We may be able to keep the eye. I don't know if you're ever going to see out of it again. You know, all about the diminished expectations, the way doctors work. They work that way in the civilian world, and apparently they work that way in the military one as well. But then they informed me that I had a long road to hoe in terms of coming back from such an injury, and my face had been shattered in numerous places. It was like an empty box. It was like a box of toothpicks in there, just scattered. All the bones were shattered and fragmented. And so it was then that I went. I was sent to New York, and the company for which I was working at the time put me up at Hospital Columbia Presbyterian in New York, and I had a number of surgeries there to rebuild my face and to save my eyeball, out of which I can see out of this damaged eye. It's very blurry and it's wavy, and I often keep it covered with an eye patch, especially when I'm working and look at my computer, because it gives me headaches otherwise. But I have 12 titanium pins and 4 plates in the side of my face, and a scar that I'm told gives me a rakish charm.
There's obviously something for being a combat correspondent. You know, the international media, if you have one of those scars and an eye patch,
I try not to abuse it, but it sometimes comes in handy.
I mean, when you realized that was there a moment then you thought, right, well, I'm not going to cross over to the other side. I'm going to still be on the planet for a couple more years. Did you then think, right, well, I need to get myself sorted and get back into you know, doing what I've been doing before? And how did that impact also, you know, the severity of your wounds on your relationship with your colleagues and also with your relationship with your, you know, with your loved ones?
Well, you know, I went from grateful to being alive, obviously, to wondering why I was alive, to feeling as though every moment I have is somehow one I've stolen. And then there's that pressure that you have, and most of this is self-inflicted. Okay, I've survived a trillion to one shot that should have killed me. Now I'm supposed to make every day count to the utmost degree. I have to be thankful for every moment. And that's frankly, there's a lot of pressure in that, having to always be happy and thankful and grateful and productive, when sometimes you just want to sit around and binge watch something on Netflix and you have to think, well, I wouldn't be able to do this if I were dead. So I have to be making the most of all my time. And I drove myself a little nuts with that for a while. Until I came to terms with the fact that, yes, this is something that I experienced and I lived through but I have to not let it define the rest of my life. Mm. And that was one of the reasons why I really had to go back to Afghanistan after I was hurt.
But didn't you think that, didn't, I mean, you could argue that what journalists do, especially journalists in your situation who go to extremes, because you've been to Haiti as well, you've been in Iraq, you've been in other combat situations, or should we say dangerous situations, risky situations. And perhaps it takes a special kind of person, there's a special sort of mindset for people who will go and see things that normal people won't actually see and transmit them back via the wonders of modern technology into people's living rooms or onto their tablets.
Right, right. You know, there's this cliche that we all use, and I'm not supposed to say this because I'm giving away I'm pulling the curtain back a little bit. But we all the common conflict journalist cliche is it's important to quote unquote bear witness and tell people what's going on, and it is. It absolutely is. But if that were the only reason why I do it, then I probably wouldn't have gone back. There's a part of me that just has to be in those kinds of situations. And I don't want to divulge all of that here because I want people to read my book.
Yeah, of course.
I will be very honest. There's a screw loose. I would say that in a handful of people, not all of them that do this, but in a good size, maybe two fistful of them, they've got a little bit of a screw loose.
Yeah,
not in a bad way, but you have to have one.
Yeah, I've got friends who've been cameramen in Kosovo and also in Afghanistan, and yes, there is something of the wild in them.
Yeah. I mean that's a prereq. You know, CPAs don't typically do this kind of work, and that's because that's why they're CPAs, and we need CPAs. I know I always do because I'm always in trouble with the IRS. But we need good people to do certain things, and there are people that have certain characteristics that tend to display and that do this kind of work.
Did you decide to start doing the book whilst you were recuperating? And also because you've got a great blog and a website, I've been looking through it before doing this interview, and you're quite candid on that about, you know, the writing style. You're up there in your cabin in the mountains, the Appalachian Mountains and whatever. Did you think, I'm going to do this, there's a book in this, I'm going to do it, or was it just sort of part of the, I'm not trying to sound facile here, but of the healing process?
No, you know what? Here's part of it was I had been asked so many times to retell this story. I figured if I would just write it out, then I could save myself the breath of having to always tell it. But then it also occurred to me that I was carrying all this around. And it was something that I felt like I could maybe unburden myself a bit if I used my writing ability to express everything I went through, how I had been feeling at that time, and how I came to terms with it, or as I am still coming to terms with it. Those were the twin motivations.
I mean, when did you decide, you know, you were going to get back on a plane and go back to Afghanistan? And who was, you know, which of your colleagues or your network employees said, yeah, I think that's a great idea, Carl, we'll put you back into Afghanistan?
Well, I had was injured in September, and my doctors finally cleared me to return to work, and not just. Obviously all my doctors said, no, you should not go back to Afghanistan, Iraq, or do any of these things, but you can return to work, as a journalist or sit at a desk somewhere on May 1st of 2011. And, I had, asked a number of my, outlets for which I was working over the years, hey, I'm getting ready to go back to Afghanistan. I want to go back and I want to work for you guys. I want to do this and I want to do that. And all of them said, no, we won't use you. All of them. Absolutely not.
Right.
Except for one. And that was USA Today. They showed an obscene amount of faith in my ability to maintain my composure going back, and they said, okay, you want to go. And they sent me there, and I went back and spent a number of months And I've since gone back. Oh, after I was hurt, I've been back on extended trips of lasting two or more months, seven times.
And what was it like, I mean, getting on the plane and flying to Afghanistan the first time and setting foot on, I mean, talk about facing your demons, Carmen, because you're setting foot in that place. It's got a distinctive smell, a distinctive landscape, a distinctive heat. Didn't they all come rushing back to you and you think, you know, what on God's green earth am I doing here?
Oh, I had puddles in my shoes. I was sweating so much. I was scared out of my goddamn mind just getting off the plane. Getting off the plane, I thought, oh, this is a terrible, terrible idea. I should not be here. I should. This was awful. I take all of this back. I'm going to just tell my editors, forget it. I'm going to turn around, beat feet and get the hell out of here. But I took a breath and I put one foot in front of the other and somehow managed to make it day to day and went back to work. But oh no, I was scared out of my mind.
And what was the reaction of, you know, the people the troops you're embedded with? You know, you turn up with your eye patch and your scars, and also the, you know, your colleagues in the media, because they've got obviously a sort of gallows sense of humor at the best of times.
Yeah, they thought, my colleagues thought that I was insane. They thought that there was that my being there was borderline, if not completely irresponsible. They didn't, even those that do this work regularly and have for a long time thought, and I don't understand why that guy's doing that. But soldiers, I have to admit, they thought it was cool. You know, they're young. They're young and indestructible. They face these kinds of dangers every day, and they thought, oh wow, this guy did that. Badass. You can be with us. So I used it to my advantage to get stories that I wanted in places I wanted to go and talk to the people I want to talk to. Yeah, if you're going to get shot in the face, you might as well exploit it.
What? I think that's going to be it. That should be a T-shirt slogan, I think, Carmen, to be honest with you. Also, you got some great little descriptions here. I mean, you describe the Afghan people as the hardiest on the planet because they've had, you know, the Russians crawling over them, but they've had the British crawling all over them. Now they've got the Americans, and they still sort of managed to eke out a life from a particularly unattractive piece of real estate where sort of growing opium seems to be the only thing they can do.
Yeah. Just the toughest people in living in the harshest conditions, and they've been doing it for millennia. There's no kid over 14 that I could beat up, and I'm a big guy.
You're right. And talking of big guys, there's a fantastic description of a certain American general, David Petraeus.
Yes.
You described him as quote unquote like Mick Jagger with a chest full of medals.
Yes. He had an entourage of fawning officers who, you know, wanted to make sure that his every need was met. And yeah, he had that's what do they call them? I don't want to call it a posse, but his, you know, his squad, yeah, of people following him around that were just catering to his every need. And, you know, with glassy-eyed admiration, they stared at this guy, and I'm thinking, he's just a man. I understand the hype, but I never really bought into it. I never really liked talking to those people because they don't tell me anything that I can really use. They talk in sound bites, and I know editors like it because they like the good get from a guy with 5 stars on his lapel, but like, I don't care. I'd rather talk to give me a private who's at the front that actually knows what the hell's going on and has been through the shit. That's the guy I want to talk to.
So when you came to sort of sitting down and writing the book, then, you know, you've got your blogs. I said you've got the excellent website. When how difficult was it for you to sit down and go through the pictures and go through the memories and get it down there?
It was rough. It was rough going. There were some days when it would flow and I felt like, okay, this story's really coming together. And there were times when I had to be really honest with myself, when I'm looking at the personal aspects of this story. I don't want to give away too much because, like I said, I want people to buy some books.
Absolutely.
You know, those were times when I was delving back into those emotional hardships. It was like I was reliving them all over again. And there was a period there, when I was working on the book, where I became very reclusive. I didn't want to friends, family, nobody. I didn't want to be bothered with anyone. was dating a woman at the time. I broke up with her so I could write the book, which is obviously not fair. But it opened those old wounds that had never really healed, obviously. And they never do. They scab over, but I ripped those scabs off and I entered that world again. And I lived inside that incident and then the recovery and the return. That the book takes place over the course of a year, and I kept reliving that year for like 3 or 4 years, which is probably not healthy.
What do you hope then the people will take away from your book? What do you hope to achieve with it?
I wrote this book because, like I said, I wrote it for me, but as for the reader, I don't consider this a doom and gloom war book. It's definitely not an academic book about Afghanistan. It's not a military strategy book in any sense. I wrote it as a means to introduce those who don't readily follow Afghanistan or even world events or diplomacy or politics, and to immerse them in that world, to give them a taste of what it's like from the perspective of one man and the people he meets and the circumstances that he's facing. And I wanted to make it compelling and entertaining and alluring enough so that people would be drawn into that story and then maybe take away from it a newfound appreciation for Afghanistan and world politics and other events. And maybe that would in ways inspire them to be more interested and be more interactive and look for other sources. And that to me was important. I'm not seeking to educate anyone on the ways and news of what's going on in Afghanistan. It's so confusing. I barely know what's going on there at any point, but I just wanted people to find a way to into that complex story through one man's perspective. I pulled them through my keyhole and asked them to look inside. And if I've done that, I'll be happy.
The book is called Blindsided by the Taliban. It's out on Skyhorse Publishing. It's by Carmen Gentile. Carmen, I know you do the media thing because I've seen the excellent website. So if they want to find out more about you or buy the book, it's going to be available as a download as well on our own virtual bookshop here on TRE. Great. But what's the address for the website?
You can find my book best on Amazon, obviously. Just look for it there, or you can find out more information about me at carmengentile.com. I have a Facebook page. Look for me there. I love interacting with readers or people who are just curious. You can find me there. Find me on Twitter. I'm real easy to recognize. I'm the dude with the black eye patch.
You are indeed. What's up for you next, then? What's your next plans?
I was in Iraq for the retaking of Mosul from the Islamic State. And in August, myself and a photographer went in there. We've been trying to tell unique stories from Iraq, trying to basically the same thing I'm doing with this book, but trying to intrigue people who normally wouldn't be interested in that story. So we went into Mosul, a place where we'd been working, the fighting is raging, and he and I are both motorcycle enthusiasts. We found this old Russian-made Ural motorcycle with the sidecar. We bought it, had it fixed, and rode it out of Mosul and into Erbil, and we wrote a story about it. And so now I'm trying to combine motorcycling and different types of stories that I like to cover.
That is fantastic. Looking forward to reading that. The book is called Blindsided by the Taliban, A Journalist's Story of War, Trauma, Love, and Loss. It's by Carmen Gentile. Carmen, we're going to run out of time, but thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care. Have a great day.